Part 10, Negotiation and Risk Management.
Chapter 42, The Rules at the Table You Didn't Know You Were Playing By. Welcome back. In Part 9, you handled the legal compliance machinery, the CE marks, the GPSR, the paperwork that keeps your goods from being returned at customs. And before that, the freight, the containers, the FOB handoffs, all the physical and regulatory architecture of getting product from there to here. Now we get to the relationship that produced all of it, the negotiation, the part where it gets human. And here's the thing about human. It's also the part where people get outplayed the most elegantly. Not cheated, not scammed, outplayed. There's a difference, and the difference matters. Buying from China isn't about applying a universal transactional logic and being politely efficient about it. It's about moving inside a system that operates by its own rules, has its own hierarchies, and has its own definition of what binding actually means. Western buyers who walk in treating it like a negotiation in Frankfurt or Chicago don't get cheated. They just get the deal that was available to buyers who didn't do their homework, which is rarely the best one. So let's start with the cultural foundations, and I want to be clear up front. This is not a travel etiquette segment. I'm not here to tell you to compliment the food and study the seating chart. The book has a full chapter on guanxi, mianzi, and indirect communication, in much more depth than we have time for here. What I want to give you is the specific mechanics that show up right at the negotiating table, the stuff you'll feel in the room. The first one is hierarchy, and it's more structural than most people expect. Decisions in Chinese companies are not made by the person you're talking to. Not typically. The sales representative across from you is probably talented, probably friendly, probably doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing, which is representing the company, not deciding for it. Significant concessions have to travel up multiple levels before they're approved. And that's not bureaucracy, that's just how decisions work. Which means, if you've been negotiating hard for 2 days, gotten somewhere, and then hear, "I need to check with my manager," that is not a stall tactic. Sometimes it is, but often it's simply the organizational reality. Learn to tell them apart.
It's a strategic move. If you're stuck in a deadlock, ask, politely, not as an ultimatum, to speak with someone more senior. Not as an escalation, frame it as, "I'd very much like to discuss this partnership at the highest level." That framing matters. It's collaborative, not confrontational, and it often unlocks concessions that the mid-level contact genuinely cannot authorize on their own. And then there's a banquet. At some point, if the relationship is going anywhere, there will be a dinner, possibly several. The host offers the first toast, ganbei, which means empty the glass. When you clink glasses, hold yours slightly lower than the host's. It's a small thing that registers as respectful rather than oblivious. And if after round three you notice a conversation drifting toward topics that might be awkward in tomorrow's session, yes, that's intentional. Drink moderately, pace yourself. If you need a reason, "I'm on medication" is widely respected and never questioned. I'm not making that up, it works. The deeper point, the relationship is part of the negotiation, not a preamble to it. Time spent building trust, reciprocating hospitality, demonstrating that you're a long-term partner rather than a one-order buyer. All of that moves the needle on terms, on quality, on responsiveness. The transaction and the relationship aren't separate tracks. They're the same track. And then there's mianzi, face. The reason a supplier almost never says no outright, even when the answer is no. The reason a problem might be signaled indirectly, a slight hesitation, a change of subject, a phrase like "it might be difficult," rather than a flat refusal. If you miss those signals and treat the absence of no as a yes, you will be surprised later, usually by the production run. The book goes deep on all of this. Here just carry the principle. Communication in this context is often indirect by design. Listening for what isn't said is as important as hearing what is. With that foundation set, let's talk about what you're actually negotiating with and who you're sitting across from.
Chapter 43, Factory or Trading Company. Find out before it costs you. Quick question. The supplier you've been messaging for 2 weeks, the one with the gorgeous product photos, the fast replies, the very reasonable quote, are they actually the factory? Maybe. Or maybe they're a very professional interface to a factory, which is a different thing. And the difference lands on your unit price. Here's the reality. A substantial portion of sellers on Alibaba.com are trading companies, not manufacturers. And a trading company typically adds somewhere between 5 and 30% to the unit price without creating any value that directly benefits you. They coordinate, they translate, they manage the factory relationship. Those things have their place. But if you're paying for them without knowing it, you're not getting the deal you think you're getting. The very good news is that you can verify this. It takes maybe 20 minutes, it's free, and almost nobody does it. Step 1. Request the Chinese business license. In Chinese, it's the Yingye Zhizhao. Then go to the National Enterprise Credit Information Publicity System, gsxt.gov.cn, and look up the company. The critical field is the business scope. If it says only sales or trade, you're talking to a trader. If it says manufacturing or production, very likely a factory. I know that sounds almost insultingly simple, and yet most buyers never do it. Then check the certificates. If a supplier sends you an ISO 9001 certificate, check the company name it's issued to. If the certificate says Shenzhen XYZ Manufacturing Company, but you're talking to Shenzhen XYZ Trading Company, you are not sitting at the factory's table. You're sitting at a table with a certificate that belongs to someone else. A word on that because it matters more than people realize. Industry estimates put the rate of counterfeit product safety certificates from China at over 30%. 30%. That means you verify every certificate directly with the issuing authority, not with the supplier, not with the Alibaba profile page, with the authority that issued it. What else tells you who you're dealing with? Location. A real factory is in an industrial zone, usually outside the city center, not downtown. A trading company is often in an office tower in a nice part of Shenzhen. Pull up Google Maps or Baidu Maps and look. Takes 30 seconds. Product portfolio. A genuine factory is specialized. If a company credibly makes pots, pans, and thermoses, they're probably in stainless steel manufacturing. If a supplier's catalog spans cable reels, yoga mats, and phone cases, that's not a factory. That's a catalog with a company address attached. And video verification. Request a live video call. Ask them to walk you through the production floor and show you the company logo on the building. A real factory does this without hesitation. A trading company suddenly develops connectivity issues. Every time, without fail. One more trap and then we move on. The gold supplier badge on Alibaba. The trade assurance program. People treat these as verification signals. They are not. They are participation signals. They mean the supplier paid for a program and agreed to its terms. That tells you something about their marketing budget. It tells you very little about whether they are factory or financially stable or especially honest. Know who you're negotiating with before you sit down. Because once you're deep into the process, once you've shared specs, discussed tooling, maybe paid for samples, extracting yourself is expensive. Verification is cheap. Verification done right is 20 minutes. What comes after a wrong call is not 20 minutes. Nowhere close. Chapter 44. The price they can't say no to and why it will cost you. Let me introduce you to the most popular sport among new importers. The aggressive price negotiation. Push hard, get a number that looks fantastic, feel like you won. And then the second order arrives. Looks right. Same packaging, same weight roughly, but the handle feels a little different. The finish is a little rougher. The material is not quite the same. This is not an accident. This is quality fate. And it's the direct, predictable, entirely rational consequence of pushing a supplier below the economic pain threshold. Here's the mechanism. A factory in China is a business. I know that sounds obvious, but bear with me. If you negotiate the price down to a point where the margin genuinely disappears, they are not going to say, no, sorry, we can't do it at that price. That would cost them face, mianzi. So they say yes. And then they find the margin somewhere else. Cheaper raw materials, thinner tolerances, skipped inspections. The production process shifts, quietly, gradually, shipment by shipment. The first batch is perfect, sample accurate, cleanly packed, on time. Your first reviews are great, you reorder. And the second batch is mostly right. And the third one is where things start appearing in the returns. By the time the trend is visible in your review average, you've already shipped the fourth batch. Quality fade is designed to be gradual. That's the whole point. The defense is layered.
First, specifications that leave no room. Not stainless steel.
AISI 304 stainless steel, wall thickness 0.8 mm. Not blue, Pantone 2728C. Not sturdy, maximum load of 25 kg with even distribution. The book covers this in serious depth because it's the single most effective line of defense you have. A spec the supplier can't deviate from without you noticing is a spec that holds. Second, ongoing quality control. Pre-shipment inspections, every shipment, conducted by an independent third party, not the factory's own QC team. An external inspector from AsiaPro, Kima, SGS, TÜV, cost runs roughly 250 to 600 euros per inspection. Compared to a full container of off-spec product sitting in your warehouse, that's a rounding error. A very comfortable rounding error. Third, backup suppliers. When a factory knows you have an alternative, the incentive to quietly optimize their margin at your expense drops significantly. An importer with one single supplier isn't a buyer, they're a dependent.
Now, while we're on the topic of prices that look too good, a quick word on the DDP trap, delivered duty paid. All inclusive to your door, cheapest possible. When a supplier offers a DDP price that's 25% below the FOB price, plus normal freight costs, every alarm should go off. Because that price is often achieved by having the freight forwarder declare incorrect HS codes or undervalued goods to customs. The importer saves on the invoice and pays in a completely different way. The legal liability for customs fraud lands on the importer, not the supplier, not the freight forwarder, you. Consequences range from back payments and penalty surcharges to seizure of the goods. A DDP price that seems magically cheap is not a good deal. It's a liability wearing a discount sticker. And a side note on where the real prices live. There's a platform called 1688.com, essentially the Chinese domestic version of Alibaba. Prices there are often 20 to 50% lower than on Alibaba.com because the export markup doesn't apply. Sounds attractive. The catch? It's entirely in Chinese, payments run in RMB via Alipay, and factories there typically don't handle their own exports. Without a local sourcing agent, it's essentially unreachable for most European importers. With a good agent, the price advantage often survives the agency fees. Something to know exists, even if you're not ready to use it yet. The chapter on all of this in the book goes considerably further. Real examples, real numbers, the full AQL standards. Here, just hold the principle. The lowest price is almost never the best deal. The best deal is the one where quality, delivery reliability, and a healthy margin all still work on the third order. That's the goal.
Chapter 45. Getting the MOQ down and the RFQ right. Two topics that are deeply connected, even though people treat them separately. First, the MOQ, the minimum order quantity. The number that every new importer immediately wants to make smaller and almost always asks about in exactly the wrong way. Can you do less? The answer is almost always no. But here's the thing. The no isn't stubbornness, it's math. MOQs are set by external constraints, minimum quantities from raw material suppliers, machine setup costs that only make sense spread across a certain run, minimum print runs at the packaging supplier, tooling amortization. The factory isn't holding out. They have real economics underneath that number. And can you do less gives them absolutely nothing to work with. It just makes them say no politely and move on. What actually works? Give them a reason to say yes. Lever 1, pay the setup and tooling costs separately. If the MOQ exists to cover fixed costs, cover those costs upfront and directly. The factory's risk drops, and so does the minimum quantity. Lever 2, offer a premium price for the trial run, 10 to 20% above the unit price framed as a pilot. We'd start with 500 units at a higher price, with a firm plan for 2,000 next quarter. The inefficiency of the small run gets compensated. The volume commitment gives them a reason to accommodate you. Lever 3. Written forecasts. A professionally prepared business plan projecting 3 to 5 follow-on orders is not empty talk, if it has specific quantities and timelines. A signed letter of intent can reduce the MOQ by 25 to 40% in real practice. Not a promise, a letter with numbers on paper. Remarkable how much more credible that is than a verbal, "We'll order a lot more later." Lever 4, material bundling. Use standard materials the factory already stocks, or consolidate multiple product variants that share the same raw material. What the factory cares about isn't the quantity per SKU, it's the total volume of raw material being processed. Give them that in a different configuration. Lever 5. Multi-SKU consolidation. Instead of fighting for a lower MOQ per product, negotiate a total volume across colors, sizes, or variants. The production process is nearly identical. The per SKU threshold drops without costing the factory any efficiency. And lever 6, payment terms. Offer faster payment or a higher deposit in exchange for the MOQ reduction. Cash flow certainty is genuinely valuable to a factory. 50% on order confirmation, 50% at production completion, in exchange for reducing the MOQ by 30%, can open doors that pure price negotiation keeps firmly shut.
Critical point. Every MOQ agreement goes in writing as part of the purchase order, before you invest in samples or tooling. Verbal commitments in China are not commitments. They are statements of intent with a flexible expiration date. Now the RFQ, the request for quotation, and the single fastest way to get useless responses and zero legal standing if something goes wrong. Vague requests are not just unhelpful, they're dangerous. If a trade assurance dispute ever comes up on Alibaba and your specification wasn't precise, the case defaults to the supplier's favor almost automatically. A vague order produces a vague result and provides zero basis for a complaint. A professional RFQ has four components. Technical specifications, not stainless steel. AISI 304, wall thickness 0.8 mm, not blue, Pantone 2728C, not strong, maximum load 25 kg with even distribution, supplemented by CAD drawings and AQL standards with exact permissible defect rates per category, critical, major, minor. The book covers this in full, here. If you can't measure it, you can't enforce it. Itemized pricing. Request a price breakdown. Unit price, tooling costs, sample costs, logistics, all separate. A lump sum price hides information. An itemized breakdown shows you exactly where the room for negotiation exists and where it genuinely doesn't.
Packaging specifications, not an afterthought. Since the PPWR packaging regulations, what your packaging is made of and how it's labeled is a compliance requirement. Address it in the RFQ or address it twice. And compliance requirements. Every applicable regulation, CE, WEEE, ROS, REACH, GPSR, battery regulation, listed concretely. Not we need CE. Which tests? Which standards? Which certificates? Exactly. A vague compliance mention gets a vague response. And a vague response gets you nowhere in front of a market surveillance authority. Get the MOQ and the RFQ right, and you walk into production with leverage on your side and clarity in writing. Skip either one and you are negotiating again later, under worse conditions, from a weaker position. Which is the least fun kind of negotiation.
Chapter 46. Contracts, IP protection and payments. The unsexy part that saves everything. Alright, this chapter has no jokes. Well, one. But we get there. Contracts, intellectual property and payment structure are where the least glamorous work in this whole business gets done. They are also where the most expensive mistakes live. Not exciting, genuinely important. Let's go. Start with IP, intellectual property. If you have a product design, a logo, a patentable function, anything that makes your product distinctively yours, you need to protect it in China. Not in Europe, not just in Europe, in China. A European trademark registration does not protect you in China. Registration is separate. It typically costs 200 to 500 euros per trademark or design, and it is the prerequisite for any enforcement action. And the contract you use matters enormously. A Western NDA, a non-disclosure agreement, is essentially decorative in a Chinese court, especially if it's written in English and references foreign law. What actually works is an NNN agreement, non-disclosure, non-use, non-circumvention, drafted under Chinese law, written in Chinese, prepared by an attorney who knows the Chinese legal system. Cost runs 500 to 2,000 euros depending on complexity. Compare that to seeing your own product design appear at three other suppliers on Alibaba 6 months later. The NNN suddenly looks like excellent value. That's the one joke I promised. A practical layer on top, compartmentalization. Never share the complete design or the full specification with a single supplier. Assign partial aspects to different vendors. Release specifications in phases, not all at once. What the supplier doesn't know, they genuinely cannot copy. That's not paranoia, that's operational discipline. And register your IP rights with Chinese Customs, the GACC. Once you do, customs authorities can seize counterfeit goods destined for export at the border. This is one of the few IP protection mechanisms in China that actually works reliably in practice. It's worth knowing about.
Now the contract itself. A signature alone is not binding in China. I want to say that again, because people hear it and then forget it in the moment. A signature alone is not binding in China. Contracts must be stamped with the official red company seal, the company chop, and signed by the legal representative. Without the chop, you have a draft, legally speaking, a very official-looking draft. Contracts should be bilingual, English and Chinese, with the Chinese version being authoritative in court. For venue, one of the specialized IP courts in Beijing, Shanghai or Guangzhou is recommended. Alternatively, include a CIETAC arbitration clause. China is a signatory to the New York Convention, which means arbitral awards are internationally recognized and enforceable. CIETAC typically runs 1 to 2 years. Litigation runs 2 to 3. Neither is fast, but faster is better. Payments. Standard structure. 30% on order confirmation, 70% before shipment after a pre-shipment inspection confirms the goods are right. Never pay 100% upfront. Never. And all payments go to a verified company bank account, not a personal WeChat wallet, not a private account that the finance team uses. A verified company account in the company name that matches the business license. The FOB Incoterm is your default. FOB means your responsibility starts when the goods are on board the vessel. The factory is responsible for export, the Chinese side of the transaction. EXW, Ex-Works, sounds simpler but shifts enormous logistics complexity onto you from the factory floor forward. Avoid it unless you have a very specific reason and a very reliable local agent handling the gap. Put all of this together and what you have is a framework that makes disputes rare and resolution possible when they aren't. The book handles the full contract architecture in detail, the exact clauses, the CIETAC mechanics, the GACC registration process. Here, just carry the non-negotiables. NNN agreement, company chop, bilingual contract, verified account, FOB. 5 things, write them somewhere.
Chapter 47. Timing the holidays, running the checklist, and what comes next.
Last chapter in this part, and it's one of my favorites, because it combines 2 things that individually feel obvious, and together form a discipline most importers never develop. First, timing, specifically the Chinese holiday calendar, and why it affects your negotiating position just as much as it affects your delivery schedule. Chinese New Year, the big one. In the 3 to 4 weeks before the holiday, production capacity gradually shrinks. Workers start traveling back to their home provinces. The remaining workforce is, let's say, mentally somewhere between the factory floor and the train station. Quality problems increase, delivery timelines get optimistic. And at the same time, suppliers are more willing to negotiate because they want to fill the order books for after the new year. You can sometimes get better terms. The trade-off is higher quality risk on what's being produced right now. After Chinese New Year, factories reopen but initially with around 35% of their workforce. Full capacity takes 4 to 6 weeks to return. And during those first weeks, defect rates are higher, MOQ negotiations are harder, and everybody is competing for the same limited production slots. It's the worst time to try to negotiate anything, and the most likely time that importers are scrambling because they didn't plan ahead. Usually because they ordered in January and hoped for February delivery. It doesn't work. It has never worked. It will not start working this year. The strategic sweet spot is 3 to 4 months before Chinese New Year, September or October. Factories are running at full capacity. There's enough lead time for production before the shutdown. And they have real interest in orders that fill the quiet gap coming in January. That's when your negotiating position is strongest. Other windows to know. Qingming Festival in April, Labor Day in May, Mid-Autumn Festival in September, Golden Week in October. Each causes 1 to 2 weeks of production disruption.
Plan 4 to 6 weeks of lead time before every major holiday, not as a rough buffer, as a firm operational rule. Importers who need goods in the first quarter must place orders by early December of the prior year. Calendar first, then everything else. Now the checklist. The distillation of everything in this part. Before the negotiation. Supplier verified through the National Enterprise Credit Information Publicity System. Business scope confirms manufacturing. Location checked. Industrial zone, not an office tower. Certificates verified directly with the issuing authorities. Walkaway point defined in writing. NNN agreement prepared under Chinese law. IP registered in China. RFQ created with exact specifications, AQL standards, and compliance requirements. 3 to 5 alternative suppliers identified. Timing checked against the Chinese holiday calendar. During the negotiation, decision maker confirmed at the table or in writing. Tactics recognized. Price breakdown received, itemized. MOQ negotiated with a real lever. Payment terms agreed in stages. Incoterm established. FOB as the default. All agreements documented in Chinese. Contract signed with company chop and legal representative. And after. Golden sample ordered, inspected, signed by both parties. Pre-production sample checked for compliance. Pre-shipment inspection commissioned through an independent third party. Container loading supervision planned for orders over 10,000 euros. Payments made exclusively to the verified company account. Documentation filed. WEEE, EPR, and packaging licensing confirmed. Next order planned with the holiday calendar already in view. I want to come back to the tactics for a moment, because we didn't name them explicitly and they deserve a name.
The Headless Horseman. Days of negotiation, compromises reached, and then my manager didn't approve that. The supposed decision maker was never at the table. Everything is suddenly back on the table. The defense. Verify before you start that the person across from you can actually say yes. If not, ask for the person who can. Death by a thousand needles. Small new demands introduced constantly, even on points already agreed. Each one feels minor. Together they shift the deal fundamentally. The defense. When you spot the pattern, draw the line clearly. Final offer. Take it or don't. And be prepared to actually walk. Someone who isn't willing to leave the table isn't negotiating. They're pleading.
We don't do it that way in China. A classic bluff for deflecting legitimate requests. Pre-shipment inspection? Not done here. Penalty clause? Unusual in China. NNN agreement? You don't need that here. The response is simple. Ask for the specific law that prohibits it. In 95% of cases, no such law exists. It's a test of whether you fold. And artificial time pressure. Slow responses right up until your departure date. Or production capacity is only available this week. The defense is what the book calls strategic silence. Go dark for 3 to 5 days. No message, no call. Most suppliers reach out on their own, noticeably more cooperative than before. Because manufactured urgency almost always means the supplier needs a deal more than you do. Now, here's the one thing I want to leave you with from this entire part. In China, you don't negotiate over prices. You negotiate over structures and safeguards. The lowest price is almost never the best deal. The best deal is the one where quality, delivery reliability, legal certainty, and healthy communication all still work on the fifth order, not just the first. Whoever understands that isn't just importing goods. They're building a supply chain that actually functions, even when no one is watching. Especially then.
The book has considerably more on each of these areas. The NNN mechanics, the full CIETSC clause, the exact AQL framework, the inspection protocols. It's all there for when you're ready to go deep. Here you've got the map and the compass.
And the survival stories, which helps. In part 11, we go somewhere familiar but different. The reorder. Because the second order is not just more of the same. It's a different negotiation, a different risk profile, a different set of conversations. What changes from the first order to the second? What to lock in, what to renegotiate, and how to start building a supplier relationship that actually scales. The first order taught you who you're dealing with. The second one tells you whether it was worth knowing. See you in part 11.